Good morning, everybody. Paul Dunn speaking, the CEO of Northam Platinum. I have with me Alet Coetzee, the CFO of Northam Platinum, and Damian Smith, who does a lot of stuff at Northam Platinum, including geology. And I think for this conversation, the renewables is also under Damian's wing. He's been around the block. We have colleagues in the room and on the line. So I'll make a few very small introductory comments, and then we'll throw it open directly for questions. It is our half year, so it's not a full year, as some others are reporting full year at the moment. And we believe it's been a good year in the sense that mining is multifaceted, and it's not often that everything comes together all at once. It normally misaligned. Three things are right and two things are wrong, or vice versa if you're unlucky. But this time, everything was lined up, and it's been a very good, generally speaking, a very good 6 months. And the headline for us probably that has enabled our board to put forward to shareholders a record, all-time record dividend of 7 rand. And bearing in mind that this is just the interim dividend. So on that note, I would say the dividend is indicative of everything, but you probably want to ask more specific questions. So I'll throw it open, and let me start in the room, perhaps, just for ease of getting everything going. And I'm going to start with Brandon. He put his hand up first, and we must just make sure there's a microphone available.
Paul, as I recall, 6 months ago, you were pretty negative to conservative or conservative to negative on prospects for the platinum business. So what is it that happened over the last 6 months to have this dramatic turnaround, which clearly you didn't expect?
Yeah, I think what has happened is the market tightened up effectively across the whole basket, and it's not tightened up a little bit. It's tightened up quite dramatically. One of the main reasons that this has happened, perhaps if I may venture, is there has been considerable change in the world in terms of the way internal combustion engines are now viewed into the future. I think prior to pretty much around about a year or two ago, it was the expectations were that the damage that would be done through penetration of electric vehicles towards the internal combustion engine would be of such a nature that it would be almost a death knell for PGMs. And that clearly has not been the case. The policy changes we've seen, agree or not agree, in some respects, it doesn't matter what your view is. This is reality now. The proposed ban of the internal combustion engine in Europe by 2035 is no more. The subsidies across the world, in particular in the US for BEVs, have been removed. And when you remove subsidies, these things are too expensive, and sales have collapsed in favor of ICE. And that is very much in line with what we're seeing in our market, where the demand for pretty much all the metals, but in particular the automotive metals, platinum, palladium, and rhodium, has strengthened quite considerably. Please carry on, Brandon.
Could you and or Alet expand on what you, Alet, were saying about the optionality for Northam's future? And did I understand you to say that you were looking at 1.5 million ounces of PGM growth target?
Now, what I said, Brandon, is we have the option, if we so choose, to, technically speaking, with relatively ease, increase the metallurgical capacity to 1.5 million ounces. That's what I was referring to. But the real optionality is always in the mine. As you know, we always say mine first, metallurgy second. So the metallurgy bit was a bit of a follow-up. The optionality we have in the mining area centers on completing the Booysendal tailings dam. And what that does, it frees up the milling capacity at Booysendal for us to do more. And that's an 18-month construction program. And as you heard me say, it took 3 years to get the permitting in place. So these things are not quick. That's why I was giving you these timelines. Anything in mining tends not to be quick, but fortunately speaking, we are now permitted and we have 18 months of construction, which in some respects is the easy bit, and then we can increase milling availability in at Booysendal and therefore mine more. At Zondereinde, what we have chosen to do is give the go-ahead to create a hole in the ground in very simple terms, which we now call number 4 shaft. The pilot hole was completed in the year gone, and we've just begun to ream that hole out to 5.5 meters in diameter from a depth of over 1,400 meters in itself. And that's fully mechanized. I mean, that's just all by machine. There are no people whatsoever involved in the excavation of that hole. And it will in itself be a world record. And that does bring some, shall we say, technical challenges. We think if things go well, it will take about 18 months. But as these things go, you can hit geology, you can hit water. It can take up to 2 years. We don't yet know until you do the job. But what that then will do 2 years hence from here is give the company the option to grow production at Zondereinde using that shaft as a rock hoisting shaft. So there are, I suppose we spoke about three broad themes. We can do organic growth at Booysendal. We can create what would be a fourth shaft at Zondereinde, number 4 shaft, which would increase production. And we can, from a technical point of view at least, relatively straightforward, increase the metallurgical capacity to 1.5 million ounces.
So that's all organic. Is M&A out of your business model now, or is it still a possible feature in future?
Yeah, we don't comment directly on M&A, but we will scan the world for PGMs, which is our job, by the way, continuously. And what is interesting, and you might believe this already, you might know this already, these assets are extremely rare. They're few and far between. This is a heavily concentrated industry already. Commercially, there are very few companies across the world that have a serious production footprint. Effectively, it's Norilsk, Valterra, Implats, Sibanye, and ourselves. I often put my hand up and show the industry like that, with Northern being the thumb. Of course, there are also some smaller ones like Teresa and Orm, but the big producers look like my hand. And the ore bodies that contain PGMs, in a nutshell, the vast majority of it is either in Russia or Southern Africa, which is South Africa and Zimbabwe. So you've got this massive geological concentration. It's unique, actually, amongst metals. Absolutely unique. Really critical strategic metals, heavily geographically concentrated, and already only 5 companies, largely speaking, with a few smaller ones, mining the stuff. And that presents quite an interesting dynamic when it comes to investments. It is already heavily concentrated and quite well known from an exploration point of view. And what is left is quite small, not inside those 5 big companies.
Thank you.
Damon, do you want to just take a few because I do think it's what it means, actually.
Yeah, so 80% of metal is in 80% of these PGMs are sitting in Southern Africa, and if you look at South Africa itself, then you have the western limb, you have the eastern limb, and you have the northern limb, where those metals are concentrated. And if you just look at a map of the Bushveld and you look at where mining has taken place in the Bushveld, and look for gaps in between where that mining has taken place. And as Paul has mentioned, you'll see very few gaps. You'll see very few gaps. What you will see is you will see that, as you would expect from mining, you start at the shallow areas. And so there is potential at depth. But with depth comes time and cost to bring those metals to account. So, there's... There are possibilities out there, but those are things that would obviously need to be explored, and whatever they are, they need capex and they need time to bring those resources into reserves and then into actual mining production. And that's the conundrum we've got at the moment, given that we've seen this continual decrease in primary production, certainly over the last 20 years. And that's something that I think all of the whole sector needs to have a really good hard look at. Thanks.
Okay, David. Thanks, David.
To use the old Toyota advert, everything keeps going right. Well, this has been a remarkable year, hasn't it? I was looking at your commentary. Your projects are all proceeding as they should do. Eland did a surprisingly good increase in production, 40%. That's remarkable.
40% chrome and 20-odd percent PGM.
And the actual mining volume is also about 40%.
Correct.
And I'm saying that can't have been those last seven teams. Obviously, all the teams are doing better. So you've had a great set of production results there. And sorry to harp on it, but I just want to say a comment about your safety. I mean, also I'm saying your next-door neighbor also had incredible, Matatola had incredible results, but full marks to Booysendal for 12 million fatality-free shifts. And just one other personal note, I last was speaking to industry 17 years ago. Yeah. So that's the better part of two decades. And to see that steady decline in serious injuries and the steady decline in the fatality rate is quite remarkable. It really is.
I must just say all the CEOs in all the council members and the CEO specifically, yeah, as led by Yapi Fulad, who's the chairman of the CEO Zero Harm Committee. Yeah. We are working extremely hard to reduce and get rid of fatalities in the first place and then reduce serious injuries across the board. But it is not, yeah, it is not a one-day event. It is a continual progression of improvement. And I do want to assure you, as now I'm speaking with a council hat on, your CEOs, because we are all part of the South African mining industry, are extremely committed on this issue.
No, it's very, 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 very good to see. And the point I made to you again, I think it's worth repeating, that for an average miner, the safest place to be is working in the mine. Once he steps out or she steps out of that property and gets into transport on the road, then their risks increase.
Yeah, the road risk is higher than at work. That, yeah, is very true.
Yeah, good. Okay.
David, and thanks for those comments.
Yeah, no, very impressive. If I may ask a couple of things about your operations. First of all, Zonda Einder, congratulations on attempting the world record or going to get the world record on the reaming. And I was very pleased to hear when you said, well, we've got more finances, we're going to accelerate CapEx. That was very good to hear. I mean, you've been a big bull on the PGMs, and to see this, that you're going to stick with your projects, it's very nice to see. It really is.
Perhaps I should give an opportunity actually for Alette to talk about how we think about CapEx and why we think like we do.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. A lot of people talk about sustainability, and when people talk about sustainability, they have this idea it's water and environmental, but in the first instance for a mining company, it's ensuring that you are there in the next couple of years. And that entails spending a lot of money, and not just on sustaining CapEx, but actually replacing your ore body as and when you mine it. We've had some very difficult years in the last sort of 5 years where everyone had to look at liquidity, and the first place where you then cut it is on your CapEx. It's an easy way. And even for Northam, we have throttled some of our CapEx programs, especially at Eland. We have throttled it even at the Western Extension. But in the first instance where we believe that our liquidity position is better, we will spend that money on CapEx. We do believe that is absolutely imperative to the PGM industry, as well as to Northam and all of our shareholders, that we ensure that we build a business that will be there for many, many years. If you look at our three operations now, all of which have got 25 to 30 year lives. So we have three almost brand new operations that will be there for a number of years. Also in terms of just sustainability, with all of our projects, we could create 12,000 jobs in some of the least economically developed areas in South Africa. Just at Booysendal, we created almost 8,000 jobs, 85% of which related to the communities in and around Booysendal. The lady that I had on the slide, Lebogang Maruta, she's actually from a very nearby village, and she studied mining engineering because of Northam. She's an intern at Northam, and she sort of started her career. So we believe in investing in our company, not just for today, but for the next 20, 30 plus years.
So I could just ask, if I may just ask Damien to comment on the mining conundrum when it comes to CapEx, because it is a perennial discussion and a very, very important issue.
Just coming back to our 25 to 30 year life of mine estimates that Alette mentioned, that's 25 to 30 years that we have currently capitalized, that we have planned and capitalized. That's going to mine out over that period at 1 million ounces, around, as you can do the equation, it's 30 million ounces. We have 200 million plus sitting in the ground in our resource base. And so that will be planned, and it will be brought to account in time. And this talks again to the sustainability that Alette has spoken to. But you need to be there to be able to do that. So you need to get through the difficult times of the cycle, and then when the good times come, as we've seen they are here at this moment in time, you need to spend money so that you can keep that momentum. A mine starts from nothing, and then an exploration program. You have to have a deposit in the ground. You have to explore it. And once you've understood it through exploration, you need to then plan that. And then you need to apply capital. And then you need to do physical work to go and build that mine. And that has a timeline. And it has a capital commitment, which is long dated. And the returns on that commitment are long dated. And so sometimes it's quite difficult to make decisions simply on a DCF or an NPV basis. And you have to have a belief in the metals that you are mining. And I think Alette elucidated to that in the results presentation. We believed in those metals for quite some time, and that's really what's driven the work that we've done. Building a mine is not easy, as Paul has mentioned as well. It takes a lot of hard work. It takes management of people. We have 23,000 people in our workforce. It takes management of people. It takes technical expertise. It takes the capital risks that we've spoken about, and it takes blending all of that and timing of all of that in order to get an outcome that delivers ultimate returns to shareholders.
Whilst managing shareholder expectations.
And Paul said it. We've all said it. We've gone and done a lot of that work as Northam through the down cycle in the 2010s, in the teens. And what did that require? It required a belief from our shareholders in order to allow us to spend money when liquidity was tight. It needed this lady here to make sure that we spent the money wisely, and it needed a lot of hard work. Sorry, Paul, I don't know what else to say. It needed a lot of hard work. We worked really hard, and we do that because we believe that we're doing something that's good for the mining sector and the world and South Africa.
Just ask one or two project-related things. No, it's very good to hear people saying CapEx first, because then everything else flows from that. And I understand that the lower years, the bad years, you have a lot of pressure not to spend anything.
It's very easy not to spend anything. Very easy to do nothing. I must just point that out. It's obvious.
It's a comfortable position to be able to do nothing.
Yeah, that's a good point. Just quickly on your shaft deepening at the main shaft. That was temporarily put on hold, and I didn't hear any mention of it today.
We completed that project in your absence, David, if I can say that. It was done.
Okay, that's on the decline shaft.
That's down to 17 level. So 17 level today is in production.
Oh, okay, so that you switched on the taps again quite quickly.
Yeah, I think you're going a long way back now, if I can say it that way. I know perhaps only 5 years or so, but we eventually did finish 17 shaft. We commissioned, and it's in production.
Okay.
17 level, sorry, excuse me. I'm getting confused with Impala there.
I don't know if it's worth mentioning the two points. Yeah, sure. As well.
Sorry.
So that decline project that you asked about was initially put together solely to mine Merensky ore from the deeper levels of the mine. We recently, in this last year, commissioned secondary ore passes, which enable now the mining of UG2 ore from those deep areas as well. That's given a huge amount of additional flexibility. Paul mentioned movement of UG2 over to the east side of the Zonderende mine. So we're mining Merensky Reef from the west side of the mine, UG2 from the east side of the mine. Now we can mine Merensky and UG2 from the deeper areas of the mine. That's brought balance back to a Zonderende mine, which was unbalanced for quite a long time. Probably you'll remember maybe back in the 2007, where a lot of mining shifted to the west side of the mine. We had congested mining. It was very difficult conditions to operate under, and the guys working there really did well. Now we have a really balanced mine. It's a good mine, and with the addition of three shaft soon to come online, and then let's hopefully ultimately four shaft, then 80 million ounces sitting in the ground at Zonderende. 80 million ounces sitting in the ground, 24 million ounces sitting in the western extension that three shaft is giving us a better logistical access to, and so there's as Paul mentioned in the results presentation, now Zonderende without end. That mine's been producing metal since 1993, and we have on the books, as Alet mentioned, 30 years. We've got schedules that run out way beyond that, so it's a great mine, absolutely fantastic mine, best grades in the Bushveld. Really good metal splits, as Paul mentioned. So, can keep going from strength to strength.
If I may just ask one more question, pass on. At Eland, first of all, it seems to be the build-up seems to be going very nicely there. I mean, from what you're telling us. Just to understand the plan for Eland, at the moment you mentioned 150 kilo ounces per year. And I've looked at your CapEx has been mainly focused on Kukama shaft. And will you expand, or will you put more CapEx into, I think, Marula or Nyala? I mean, is that the final target, 150, or is there a target beyond that?
So the 150, your numbers are correct. 150,000 ounces is focused on Kukama shaft. Okay. You're quite right, David. We have not yet exploited Nyala shaft. We have exploited Marula belt, which is next door. So we've actually put Marula belt and Kukama together as one now. They've interconnected. They were not interconnected. We've now interconnected them, and we're mining through from one to the other. So consider it as one undertaking, if you wish, and that's the 150. Nyala is outside that number. It is another shaft. It's further towards Pretoria.
Yeah.
And at this stage, there's very little activity at that shaft at this stage.
So that's an option, a further option.
It may be, not just yet. I think I'll tell you why I say not just yet is because we only 60% of the way there in ramping up to the 150. There's still what I call a lot of hard yards to do, and that will take us until 2029 to complete. So it's a little bit early to be thinking about the next one, as far as I can see, that physical activity that we have to complete.
Thank you.
Will overstretch us, in other words. That's what I'm trying to say. We'd be biting off too much.
I'd just like to look at the demand side. Am I coming over? Okay. You said that hydrogen had been overestimated. now hydrogen is being underestimated. You recommended that we travel to China and go and have a look. What would we see?
Now you will see something very interesting. Very interesting. We picked this up actually in Japan with our customers. Mitsubishi introduced us to one of the Chinese companies. There's lots of historic trade relationships between Japan and China. So when we visited Japan, we were introduced to this company, who is a Chinese company operating in North China. And just happened chance, they started talking about hydrogen. And we thought, geez, this is very interesting. And we didn't have enough time. It was a very short discussion. So we said, can we come and visit you in China? And they said, of course. Company's name is Hychem, by the way. It's an English name, but it's, you know, obviously got a Chinese name as well. So we had a follow-up visit, a dedicated follow-up visit, and they happened to be operating in the very north of China. It's quite remote, somewhat unhospitable, if you can put it that way. It's not where people go. And what we found there was quite incredible, quite incredible. It's a coal mining area. And the area in which they're operating is coking coal. And the Chinese government has, in recent times, issued a directive that if you mine coal, you must do something with hydrogen. You must do something with that coal to split the coal a la Sasol and make chemical building blocks so you can beneficiate into many chemical, whatever, you know, chemistry you might want. You know, it's very similar to the foundation of Sasol. Sasol, oil from gas, coal to liquid, all those technologies. Actually, what they do, they make raw chemical building blocks when you do that. And that enables you to do many, many other things, as you see with Sasol. The consequence of doing that is when you break up the coal chemically, you release lots and lots of hydrogen for free. It's called in colloquially now gray hydrogen. So it's not green hydrogen. It's what people refer to as gray hydrogen. In other words, it's hydrogen emerging from chemical processes that has their foundation in carboniferous material like coal. Nevertheless, it's hydrogen. And these guys have captured not more than 1 or 2% of that hydrogen. And they're running literally hundreds and hundreds of trucks in their hub, all fuel cells. Very interesting, by the way, Toyota fuel cells. They say the Toyota fuel cells, you know, the language, of course, for us is a problem, so we use a translator. But, you know, you can see they really mean it. These Toyota fuel cells are doing the job. And they've literally created this, like, micro economy of fuel cells in and around the gray hydrogen. So then we go back to Beijing and we meet with the head of the SOEs, all run directed. It's a directed economy, as you know. So the head of the hydrogen drive in China is a lady, you know, proper solid PhD, you know, amazingly educated woman, and as you would imagine. And our guy, Herbie, you might remember Herbie Heldenes. He's still downstairs. So those of you who know Herbie, had the presumption to challenge this lady through the interpreter and say, I know he's been hearing about this. Now the green hydrogen, because we've seen the gray hydrogen. We say, we've seen the gray hydrogen. We can see it's working very well and very good to see. But then he challenged the head of strategy there and said, we, you know, effectively said, we've seen this, we've heard it for decades, and we don't believe you. He basically said it as bluntly as that. That lady lectured him in Chinese through the interpreter for half an hour. Not joking, and getting angrier and angrier and angrier. It was an absolute affront, that question. You know, we basically, not intentionally so, but the way we are, we were too blunt. And the question was answered just as bluntly back. It's in the 5-year plan. It's in the 15-year plan. We are going to do green hydrogen. Interestingly enough, we are seeing a strong demand now for iridium. And that iridium demand can only really come from electrolyzers. And electrolyzers are the piece of kit that you use to split water to make hydrogen. And that demand is coming from China. So we think we would agree both with your statement, Martin, you reiterated my statement. I do believe we're now underestimating what's happening.
And when you talk fuel cells, you're talking platinum as well. I mean, you can't have a fuel cell without platinum.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. So both fuel cells and electrolyzers use platinum, both sides. So to create hydrogen and to use hydrogen, you use platinum. But to create hydrogen, you tend to use iridium. And to use hydrogen, you used to use a bit of ruthenium. So on the one side, it's platinum ruthenium. The other side, it's platinum iridium. And that's very interesting.
You know, there were times when I came here, I used to ask you about renewables and people didn't really respond. It's great that you now, wow, you're so deeply immersed in it. But I saw our president sitting at the Abu Dhabi Sustainability Summit and he was talking to the president, president to president, and they were chatting and he was saying, there's a massive opportunity in Africa to have green hydrogen. This could be the future in Africa. But I don't see any mining companies here sort of saying, well, you know, we've now got the renewables. Can't we do something in our own space that drives our little things and our trucks like they're doing with hydrogen? We saw it attempted at Mogalakwena, but nothing has happened since then. What, now, are you guys still just saying, no, 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 that's not our scene at this stage? Or will you do something?
Mining people, in particular companies like Northern, which are, you know, let's face it, we are a smaller company. We would see ourselves as a quick follower from a strategic point of view. So if we see it, we'll adopt it. That's the way we see it. But what I'm trying to say, I believe it's coming.
Yeah, I hope so. And then I was grabbed by one of these analysts here, and Brendan was there, and he seemed to understand the South Tailings, and I don't know what the devil was going on there. Now, this South Tailings seems to have unlocked quite a lot, and with these tailings, do they just sit there? You can't remine them like they do with gold or anything like that.
Well, I'm gonna let Damien answer that one, Martin. I just must say to the team on the call, We have gone on a bit, so it's probably, I'm going to check the lines just now, but in the room, this is the last question. So, Damien, if you're going to.
And I'll try and answer it pretty quickly. The South concentrator for Booysendal South Mine, was a concentrator that used to be the concentrator for the Everest Mine, the Aquarius Everest Mine. And the tailings dam was the old Everest tailings dam. And it was sized for the Everest operation, which is a relatively small operation. We've got large operations that's happening in Booysendal South. And when you look at a tailings dam, what's important on a tailings dam is how much material you deposit onto that dam, the area of that dam, the amount of material going onto the dam divided by the area of the dam gives you the rate of rise of that dam. And the rate of rise of the dam talks to then the stability of the dam. We need a bigger dam to ensure that we have a rate of rise that gives us the correct life of mine solution for stability of that dam to ensure that it's safe over the life of mine. That's why we're expanding that dam. If we don't expand the dam, we have to throttle back the concentrator. We can't open the concentrator up to its full capacity because we're having to limit what we can deposit onto the tailings dam. That's the debottlenecking of the South concentrator. That debottlenecking of the concentrator means that we can mine more ore. We've got 100 million ounces sitting in the ground at Booysendal. We've got 6 mining modules there, and so there is a potential for us to up the mining rate and get it milled, because it doesn't help you mining if you can't ultimately mill it, and that's really where the value add is from that initiative. As Paul mentioned, 18 months until we can start depositing onto that, so we're not going to get immediate pickup. We'll get that in time.
You've got everything out of that. You can't get anything more out of this. And even the Everest guys, they didn't leave anything behind.
We reprocessed that dam once already, Martin. I must tell you, we did do that. When you take the PGM out of it, small quantities, so it had to be redeposited on the same area. So it's still pretty much the same size of material, but we did denude it of recoverable PGMs already. Yeah, so there was a bit left. If I can go to the lines, please, if there are any residual questions from the lines that anybody would like to ask.
We have a few questions on the line, sir. The first question comes from Ed Stoddart of Daily Maverick. Please go ahead.
Thanks, Ed. Ed, I think you're on mute.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, now we can. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm. Thanks. Yeah. Sorry, I'm not there as usual drinking tea with you at this time. I'm on the road. But I just wanted to ask. With the way the price is going, and with the way everything's going, and by the way, just sparkling results. Well done. I'm just wondering. I guess it underscores the importance now of the stability that's been brought to the eastern limb of the platinum belt in the past couple of years. And I was just wondering if you could speak to that a bit. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Ed. I agree that, you know, in times gone by, it has been fractious on the eastern limb. And, you know, I would say probably in the last two and a half years, maybe, we've had a stable relationships. And just to, you know, you might ask me, well, how did that happen? Effectively, the mining companies are working together. We meet once a month, actually, at they call it the Eastern Limb CEO Forum. And there's a monthly discussion about issues that affect the area generally. And cooperatively, we've been doing a few things. Which includes we built a very important bottleneck bridge. We've been repairing like serious repairs of long kilometers of roads. We've got a school going collectively. So we're doing stuff over and above. We're looking at security in the area. We're doing stuff over and above and outside the SLPs, which are specific to the individual mines, and we're doing a few collective items, and that's got full support from the individual CEOs, you know, in that area, which has helped a lot. I must say, we've also had quite a bit of help from government, from a policing point of view, which calmed the whole thing down in the first place. And that there's less of a requirement now for that type of intervention that there used to be. And yeah, I'm pleased to say that stability is definitely better than what it was. If I could, thanks, Ed, and right. Thanks for the compliments. If I can move on to the next question.
The next question we have comes from Lisa Steyn of News 24. Please go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. If I may just ask about the metal split again, I'm sorry if I missed it, but exactly how much higher is your average basket price compared to your peers at the moment?
Yeah, I think the best way to good afternoon, Lisa. The best way to think about it is the basket price differential is coming actually from the ore body itself. So UG2, as we speak at the moment, has an average basket price around about 30% higher than Merensky. I'm just checking my sums are correct in the room. I'm getting nods from Alette and Damien. So there are predominantly in the Bushveld two types of ore bodies, Merensky and UG2, and UG2 is about 30% higher than Merensky. Many of the companies historically run on about a 50-50, broadly speaking, 50-50 Merensky UG2. We are about a 80-90 in favor of UG2. So we're a lot heavier on a weighted basis. We have a lot heavier UG2 percentage than our peers, just by the fact of the ore bodies we have at our disposal. I think the other differentiating factor perhaps is we have a full mine-to-market chrome business segment, which is not the case elsewhere. So we own the chrome mine-to-market, and that also comes, as it happens, from UG2. And as Alette pointed out, it's interesting to point out that between chrome, ruthenium, and iridium, all of which come from UG2, that made up 18%, 19% of our revenue. So, you know, it is quite a significant differentiator. And it is, again, I'll stress, a reflection of the ore body
We're not necessarily cleverer than anybody else. It's just what we have. And that's how the metals are priced as we are speaking today. That's the reason for it. Thanks, Lisa.
Okay, thank you. I just also want to quickly ask about the renewables. Have you seen any issue? Have you encountered any major issues with Eskom? I've just been reporting this week about two issues around renewables projects in Sibanye Stillwater. So I was just wondering if there's anything that you have noted. And the on the balance sheet projects now, is this the model going forward? And when you talk about the industrial batteries, what type of battery are they exactly? Thank you.
So no real problems. Sorry, this is Damien Smith. So we've not picked up significant problems from any of the authorities that we need to interact with on the permitting side of things. Permitting does take quite some time, and you just have to go through the process. I think what was important to us was we tried to move as quickly as we could in the early phases of our renewable program. No significant problems. The move towards the owner-operated model was on the basis of the metal price pickup and improved liquidity and the improved returns on owner-operated installations against power purchase agreement benefits. And batteries, lithium-ion batteries, and the standard technology on those lithium-ion batteries will be utilizing 5.5 megawatt hour battery units, and we'll ultimately, or in this first phase, be looking at around about 370,000 megawatt hours of battery installations, predominantly at Zonderende, and then at Eland, and then we'll put some in at Booysendal. And as Paul mentioned in the results presentation earlier on, the reason that we want to use those batteries is because we want to undertake peak tariff arbitrage. We want to put energy into the batteries during daylight hours and through solar or from the grid, and then discharge that during the peak tariff periods where the average cost of energy is about three times what it is outside of peak tariff period. So you get much better price or cost benefit on your electricity.
Thank you. One last thing on that. I mean, it seems to me that this is culminating in an extreme revenue crisis for Eskom. Isn't that going to raise your electricity costs further? I mean, will it not cancel out the benefits in the long term, or how do you see it working out?
Yeah, the general trajectory, Lisa, I think we all have seen that we've been experiencing historically double-digit price increases, and as council says, 800 to 900% implication over the last 10 years. So you know, we are tremendously affected by that, and we have to take action to protect our business. And the best way we can do it is to move away from Eskom as far as possible through a renewable program, which is very cost effective at this stage. But I must point out that for some of the energy, we will always still be reliant on Eskom. And, you know, I do believe that price increases are here with us already, if I can say it that way. And even this year, you see NERSA ruled in favor of Eskom once again with that additional makeup that they awarded. So the best way we as a company can deal with this is to move as far as possible over to renewables. The first three projects that we outlined today will take away 60% of the energy from Eskom to the renewables, and probably we'll do a lot more than that still with these homegrown or home-owned behind the meter self-funded batteries and PVs in the coming years. So that's where we're going as Northam. We have an advantage in a way that we're a bit of a smaller company So 100 megawatts to Northam has more significance, perhaps, than 100 megawatts, let's say, to a larger competitor. So we can move quite quickly and we can reduce our costs accordingly. And in a way, we're going to be quite unabashed and blunt about it. This is what we got to do. I hope that's answered the question, Lisa. I'm sorry we rushed you a bit, but I'm getting like nudges here that we need a hard stop. If that's okay, can we close the session? I hope everybody had a chance. And if not, please send us your questions on the email or through Russell's and Associates, who will pass the questions on to us and we'll give you a written response before the end of the day. Thanks, everybody. Sorry to cut it short. Appreciate it. Thanks. Bye-bye.